From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is meeting now at the White House with Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi to try and avoid a partial government shutdown later this month. The president wants the funding bill to include money for his border wall. Today he tweeted that the wall will get built. He also added that much of the wall has already been built. One of the people who will vote on the funding plan is Republican Congresswoman Debbie Lesko, who represents Arizona's 8th Congressional District. She joins us from Washington. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So a new poll out today from NPR and PBS finds that 57% of people polled want the president to compromise on the border wall and reach a deal. That's about 30% of Republicans as well. Would you vote for a bill that doesn't include the $5 billion in funding for the border wall that the president has been asking for?
Well, we've been compromising all along. So I co-sponsored and voted for what's called the Goodlatte Number 1 immigration bill, which would have not only provided the funding for a border wall and more agents and more technology, but it also would have allowed the DACA recipients to stay here legally. So it would have solved that problem. And it's really unfortunate that not one single Democratic congressman or woman voted for it. The bill failed. So when we talk about compromise, I've already been willing to compromise. I think it's time that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and the rest of the Democrats compromise with us.
But what if they won't do that?
Well, then if it goes into a shutdown, I blame it on the Democrats. The majority of the people in my district, the majority of the people in the nation want a secure border. They want to know who's coming here.
What would you say, though, to people who say that the money that the president wants for the border wall would be better spent if the issue is all these people who are fleeing Central America? The money would be better spent shoring up those countries, as Mexico is doing. They're going to be spending $30 billion over the next 5 years on development in Central America.
Well, I certainly think we can do both. We can help other economies so that their citizens want to stay there, but the countries have to help themselves. Part of the compromise needs to be funding to secure the border. Now, that includes a wall. It also includes more border security. I've gone down to the border in the Nogales area of Arizona, and the Border Patrol agents have told me directly that one of the things they need is a wall or fence or whatever you want to call it. You know, we're a very loving nation. We already allow legally about 1 million legal immigrants to come into our country each and every year. That's more than one congressional district a year we're adding with legal immigrants. And so I'm compassionate, especially for the women and children that are traipsing thousands of miles to get to a better life. But we also need to make sure that our laws aren't used to be exploited by cartels that are abusing these people.
I want to ask you about something else. Time magazine has just chosen the journalist Jamal Khashoggi and other journalists who've been targeted for their work as Person of the Year. As you know, President Trump has called the media the enemy of the people. What do you think about Time's decision there, and what do you think about the president's rhetoric on the media?
Well, you know, I don't think that we should be targeting the media. However, I do think, and I have witnessed personally, where some media have reported falsely on things that I've been involved in. So I do think that is a disservice to the American public.
So that's part of the answer. So you don't believe that journalists are the enemy of the people?
I do not believe journalists are the enemy of the people, but I would encourage journalists to make sure that they check all the facts and at least call the congresswoman or congressman that you're going to talk about. That's another thing. They usually don't even call. They just report things that are just inaccurate without even talking to us.
I just want to ask you one more thing. You're going to be one of just 13 Republican women in the House, down from 23 Republican women in the House this year. You're also the only woman in the conservative House Freedom Caucus. Do you think that Republicans are falling behind when it comes to representing women in this country?
Well, we are. We have to do a better job. And it is, you know, I usually don't talk about women versus men. I just talk about who's the most qualified. Certainly the women that are currently serving in Congress, whether they're Democrat or Republican, are good people that want to help their constituents. But certainly, I mean, over 50% of the public that votes is women. Mm-hmm. And so Republicans need to do a better job of recruiting women and then helping them once that they're there. And that is going to be one of the focuses that I'm going to work on.
You think there should be a woman in the leadership in the House on the Republican side?
Well, and there is. Right now, it's Kathy McMorris Rogers in the conference chair, and now we just elected Liz Cheney to take her place. And Liz is a very well-spoken, articulate person that really, I can tell you behind the scenes, that she really stands up for what she believes in, and she'll stand up to any man any day of the week.
That is Debbie Lesko, who is a congresswoman representing Arizona's 8th Congressional District. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, now a problem that affects millions of Americans, student loan debt, which has grown at a painfully fast rate, up more than 150% in the last 10 years since the Great Recession. And some people graduate with so much debt, it's changing the way they live their lives. Ben Marcus of Colorado Public Radio has more from Denver.
Green Lady Gardens is like a verdant oasis from the concrete and bustle of downtown Denver. The small space is packed with plants. Jessica Schutz says she started this store to fill a need.
I felt like all the other houseplant stores were just kind of boring. They're all just white walls, kind of uninspiring. And I really like colors and I really like plants. And plants and colors are in, so it's like my time.
Dig a little deeper, and Schutz's story is shaped not necessarily by a love of plants, but by larger economic forces. She originally wanted to be a conservationist. She went to college in Colorado, and then grad school in Montana. She was a Fulbright scholar, studying in Mongolia when the Great Recession hit.
I remember my dad calling me being like, things are really bad here, things are really bad. You know, and I'm like working in the countryside, I have no idea. I'm like, oh, it's fine. I'm going to have a degree. It's going to be amazing. I'm going to get the job of my dreams. And I came back and that was not the reality. And so things are very, very different than what I expected.
She graduated into the worst job market since the Great Depression. Despite years of study and some impressive academic credentials, she couldn't find a job that matched her skills. And then there was the matter of loans, which create a constant sense of urgency.
My student loans are almost as much as our mortgage every month. Yeah.
She's had to work at admin jobs to pay down some of that debt. A loan from her mom helped her buy a house. And she got a line of credit thanks to equity in her home and opened the plant shop. She says she hopes someday to get back to the environmental movement. Student loan debt is one of those things that sneaks up on many.
But yeah, there are some students who do not consider the impact of what they're borrowing until they're wrapping up their college education.
That's Ben Wurzel. He runs the Money Sense program at the University of Colorado Boulder, which helps students figure out their finances after graduation. Wurzel works with many students who are surprised how much and how long they'll be paying off their loans. He says in the vast majority of cases, higher education is worth the investment. The average debt load in Colorado is $27,000, which Wurzel says is manageable.
It's when you start getting way above that, and also when you start seeing six-figure debt loads, that you want to be really careful about how much you're borrowing and think about how you're going to pay that back.
That's easier to do if the degree is something like engineering or computer science, a lot harder if it's a liberal arts degree. Ben Keyes is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania who studies student loan debt. He says success with any degree is actually a matter of timing.
And so it's really a function of bad luck or good luck. If you graduate into a good economy, there's going to be more plentiful jobs, better paying jobs, and it's going to be a lot easier to pay off your loans.
Keyes says it's not surprising that many students graduate with little understanding of their future loan debt or how difficult it is to get that debt forgiven. It's out of sight, out of mind for most. He says there must be a greater effort to counsel students before they start accumulating debt, and that states should help make higher education more affordable.
And I think we need a much broader recognition that the big increases in tuition have really shifted the burden onto younger and younger people, and they really need our help when times are tough.
and payments on the loans are due just after graduation, when their earning potential is at its lowest. He says this debt can delay home ownership, marriage, and other life milestones. Jessica Schett's timing in the job market was terrible, her loan debt high, but that didn't slow her down. It just altered her trajectory.
I don't know, the Great Recession, then coming back to student loans and just having to have that necessity of how do I make it work and be happy.
She could have toiled at jobs she hated to pay the loans back and been bitter.
But that's not really in my nature.
Instead, she found a new passion, selling houseplants. But she readily admits she's fortunate to have a supportive family and husband. Other graduates are not so lucky. For Here and Now, I'm Ben Marcus in Denver.
And now a story about a Chinese researcher using the gene editing program CRISPR-Cas9 in a secret project he says will benefit the recipients and mankind. But there are risks, and one of them could be a gang from China out to sabotage the work to make it fail. Okay, this isn't the current headline about the Chinese scientist who claims to have used CRISPR to edit the genes of twin girls to make one resistant to the HIV virus carried by their father. It's new fiction from Robin Cook, and it's about a Chinese researcher raising pigs in New Jersey and editing their genes to transplant their hearts to humans. But it's so close to the headlines. Author and Dr. Robin Cook is known for such medical thrillers. Take Coma. His new novel, Pandemic, is about CRISPR-Cas9. He joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, you always seem right on the edge of these things. What did you think when you heard the headline out of China and knew what your storyline was?
I said I knew it was going to happen. The fact that my bad guy, so to speak, is a Chinese individual was not by accident. The Chinese are very interested in biotechnology, as they are in all technologies. And it's also true that the Chinese philosophy is somewhat different from our philosophy. Mm-hmm. They don't have the same sense of the importance of the individual versus the society. So if anybody was going to be using CRISPR-Cas9 in the wrong way, I thought the good chance was it was going to be a Chinese individual.
Well, when you say in a wrong way, the questions about what really happened, let's talk about that first, in China, this scientist who revealed that he did gene editing, there were twin girls, and made one of them, he says, resistant to the HIV virus. That is what some say the right way. So what was wrong about that? I mean, I'm imagining first that it was in secret.
Well, that it didn't have any peer review, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. It also is known that as accurate as this CRISPR-Cas9 is, that it's not completely, totally accurate. There can be other changes, other places in the genome, which if these kids survive and they go on to reproduce, that will be part of the human genome. That's really the worry.
Well, because, and let's remind ourselves, CRISPR is a molecule that can be, as you write, custom tailored to seek out and alter genes in plants or animals. And then those genes are passed on to daughter cells. And so it just continues.
Only if you do it in the germline. You can use CRISPR, which is how most of us see it being used in terms of treating an individual, but not putting it into the germline so that when they have children, whatever happen to them is not going to happen to the children.
Well, and as you point out, what was done in China can be passed on.
Yes, that's a worry. And, you know, the other thing is, even though it sounds like it might have been, well, protect these infants from HIV, which the father had, it's already known that since the fathers were on anti-HIV medication, that they wouldn't pass it on. Hmm. So why did you do this? And without knowing what else is going to happen. But the real problem, I think, that most researchers feel is that this episode is going to encourage legislators to suddenly want to put restrictions on this CRISPR technology. The promise of this technology is unbelievable.
Well, in fact, in the opening of the book, you say this is dedicated to the mystical clairvoyance that some gifted scientists have, which allows them to look at data available to all and see diamonds in the rough, resulting in a scientific quantum leap forward such as the case with Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Marie Charpentier, responsible for the gene editing technology CRISPR-Cas9 and its evolving permutations. So you see it as, you know, mystical clairvoyance, but then, as you write in your prelude, dark, dark side.
Well, I believe that this CRISPR will prove to be one of the true milestones in biotechnology, maybe even more important than the discovery of antibiotics.
Well, hold on there, because you've just said that what happened in real life in China, yes, they may have adjusted a gene so it doesn't pass on something, but there may be another side effect. I mean, these children may, you know, be susceptible to pneumonia. I just made that up, you know. In other words, it may have a side effect they don't know.
Oh, you're very accurate in that.
Oh, okay.
Actually, it's that same protein that they altered that is responsible for HIV getting into cells. By altering that protein, it also makes it easier for West Nile virus and influenza to get into the cell.
There you have it.
So you're protecting a little bit on one side and you're opening up on the other side.
Well, but you outline in your fictional story in Pandemic another problem, which is, and we don't want to give too much of the plot away, but your story is set both in New Jersey, where a wealthy Chinese scientist has settled and is funding a hospital and a gene research empire. We're also in New York, where people mysteriously start dying on the subway, and these two storylines are hurtling at each other. But the element that you introduce is, yes, you might inadvertently have a side effect of what you've done with gene editing, but somebody may come and tamper with your gene editing. That's scary as heck.
Exactly. And indeed, in Pandemic, by using CRISPR-Cas9 to get so that we can use pig organs for transplantation, it unleashes another illness that would never have affected humans except by doing it this way.
And because these Chinese researchers in New Jersey feel that by raising these pigs and harvesting these organs, they have done gene editing on it, so there won't be a problem. But there is a problem.
Yeah.
And now suddenly we're in the world of the, is it the 1918 flu outbreak? And our investigators, our health investigators, are panicked that they're on the edge of that. Talk just a little bit about your research in that area. I mean, did you travel around with medical examiners and city health officials? Because it feels like you did.
I actually took a course in forensic pathology myself in order to be able to write these books. And I have indeed talked to lots of medical examiners. And indeed, I'm also one of those people who is terrified of a repeat of the 1918 flu pandemic. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people feel, well, nowadays with antivirals and antibiotics, that couldn't happen today. What very well possibly could happen today. And so those of us in the know are always a little bit afraid of that, especially when you start seeing certain strains of flu popping up here and there. I mean, you read about it in the newspaper, a new flu strain that kills, 20 people in China. And you think, well, thank goodness it's in China. But the way the world is interconnected now, this could really, really happen.
Are there really tents stashed and trucks stashed in places in New York City for the outbreak of a...
For those people, I mean, they have been training in New York City for a repeat of the 1918 flu pandemic. They have mobile units. They can erect and actually make different morgues out in the parking lot in tents to deal with. If you have 300, 400, 500 deaths a day in New York City, can you imagine what this would be like?
Okay, so we have, it's a typical Robin Cook book. We are afraid of that, and we also have this technology, this gene technology, which you're very fluent in. And we read in an acknowledgement that this all started when a Dr. William Hurlbut, an adjunct professor of neurobiology at Stanford's medical school, first got you to a conference on CRISPR. In that moment, did all the light bulbs go off for you?
Not right away, but I knew of this and I had been reading about this and I wanted to write a book about it because that's really what I do. I write fiction to entertain people, yet also to get them to understand some of the amazing things that are happening in biotechnology and medicine today.
Because is all the biotechnology and medicine in your book real?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I'm very careful about that. Otherwise, it's not going to scare people. And I want it to scare people who are even in this field. So I have to be very realistic about it.
And well, so how concerned, maybe frightened are you that we have one scientist coming forward who was working in secret? In your book, we have another there's a good chance there's a lot of people working in secret, maybe making some of these small mistakes that can just blow into pandemic and change life as we know it.
That's true. There's a lot of things that would keep you awake at night if you knew what was going on.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the fact that CRISPR is so powerful and so easy to use.
Oh, as you say, any high school kid with just a couple skills can do it.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, it's just horrifying. But again, your books, you just said you mean them to be cautionary. You also
But they also are fun.
Oh, yeah. But you also have a storyline about somebody's child who looks to have autism, and you throw in a little debate over whether or not the mother should have given her a vaccine, and your character is outraged that that conversation is still going on. There is no evidence of autism created by vaccines. It feels as if this is Robin Cook really screaming into the wind.
That is one of the issues that I'm particularly interested in, yes, because vaccines are a tremendous help, probably more help in terms of saving lives than even antibiotics. And the fact that conspiracy-minded people think there's something wrong and tell their neighbors, et cetera, even though it's been totally disproved, these vaccinations do not cause autism. Yeah. There's still people out there who believe it does.
Look, has the movie been cast? Is it already being filmed?
No, but we do have a movie deal. I have noticed that my fan base really enjoys Jack and Lori, these two characters who work at the New York City Medical Examiner's Office. So we're going to do a TV series with Jack and Lori.
Dr. Robin Cook, his latest book, which involves the CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing technology, also fears of pandemic, two storylines there. The book is Pandemic. Robin Cook, thanks so much.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
An astonishing clash on camera at the White House today between President Trump and congressional Democrats over border security and a government shutdown. But after months of disagreement, lawmakers have reached a compromise on the Farm Bill. The bill provides crop subsidies. It also includes the food stamp program known as SNAP. The compromise version of the bill does not include the strict work requirements for food stamp recipients that Republicans had wanted. And it also legalizes the industrial production of hemp. Congress is expected to vote on it this week. And speaking to reporters today, the president said he likes the bill. He thinks it's in good shape. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
So Congress passes a farm bill roughly every 5 years, usually with broad bipartisan support. This one has taken a lot longer, though. What was different this time and how did they finally reach a compromise?
Well, the thing to remember about the farm bill is that in this particular one that they've reached a compromise on, more than 75% of it is SNAP. It's food stamps, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Mm-hmm. So that always comes under a lot of fire, particularly from conservatives who think there should be less of it and that there should be work requirements. And what happened here is that because the Democrats are taking control of the House in January, Republicans figured, let's get some bill that passes with some Republican input rather than the one that the Democrats would pass without them. So the change of the House motivated the success of this bill.
Okay, and even without those work requirements for food stamps, there was also a lot of controversy around commodity subsidies as lawmakers were debating this legislation. These are the subsidies farmers get when their average revenue falls below a certain level. Has there been much change to the subsidies from the previous bill?
So there's changes to how farmers can access those subsidies. Usually these are about $5 to $8 billion a year. They're expected to increase under this bill, obviously, because a lot of products that are farmed in America are now stuck, things like soybeans, which the Chinese have imposed tariffs on. So the issue here is that under current law, farms operated entirely by families can have an unlimited number of managers as long as they're actively engaged in the business. And what's happening here is that they're expanding the definition of families or people who are on the farm, families working as managers, to first cousins, nieces, and nephews. So making more people eligible for commodity subsidies. Mm. Some people don't like that. The payments, by the way, are capped at $125,000 per person. But if you got multiple family members, you can multiply that.
Okay. And what about the legalization of the industrial production of hemp? Tell us about that. And does that mean anything for U.S. cannabis companies and investors?
Well, it means something insofar as it's one more step that the federal government is taking toward the acceptance of the influence of cannabis. Hemp is now will fall under this as an industrial product to be farmed. It doesn't deal with the issues about CBD and the federal restrictions on cannabis, but this could be a $20 billion a year business as soon as 2022. So a lot of farmers were sort of worried that if America doesn't sort of catch up to Canada and other places, we're going to miss out on that. So right now, industrial hemp production in the United States has been mostly restricted to research and pilot programs. Under this farm bill, it can actually be farmed as a product under the terms of the farm bill.
And we're likely not going to be talking about the farm bill for another 5 years?
That's probably the case. There are probably going to be some little things here and there, but fundamentally, this is good for 5 years. It's actually budgeted for 10, but it gets renewed every 5 years.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Next month, the new freshman class of Congress will take their seats in the House of Representatives, and among them will be the youngest black woman ever elected to Congress, 32-year-old Lauren Underwood. Underwood unseated a four-term Republican incumbent to win Illinois' 14th district, and she joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being here, and you're going to be among the youngest members of Congress. So I want to start by asking you about something that is very important to young people in this country, and that's student loans. 44 million Americans are now shouldering $1.5 trillion in outstanding student loan debt. Young people under the age of 35 hold almost half that debt. Is that a big issue for you as you start in Congress, since you're going to be among the youngest?
Certainly. It's very clear that we are in the midst of a student loan crisis in our country. So many of my peers, I graduated from college in 2008, in the spring of 2008. And as we all know, in the fall of 2008, our economy and our country just collapsed. And so many in my cohort specifically remain underemployed, perhaps underpaid, and have significant loan debt that has become a real barrier and obstacle to be able to meet major life milestones like purchasing a home, saving for retirement, being able to plan forward in the future. And when I think about the opportunities for intervention, I really identify a few things. Number one, we have to have a financial aid system that reflects the way that the modern student approaches higher education. So we know that in this country, the average college student is not 18 or 19 years old. The average college student is maybe 27 or 35, and is going to a four-year institution year-round in order to complete their degree as quickly as possible. And our current financial aid system, specifically Pell Grants, don't allow for those students to use their grant in perhaps like a spring or summer term, right? They're not allowed to use it year-round. I think that is an opportunity for some modernization. Second thing we can do is make sure that the subsidized student loans and that Pell Grant are now in combination going to reflect the total cost of tuition. It's no secret that tuition prices have been rising as the share of federal and state investment in higher education has been dropping. And so those costs are now being passed on directly to the students and the families. And so we have an opportunity at the federal level to make sure that the Pell Grants and the subsidized loans are reflecting the true cost of tuition payments. And that's going to be one of my priorities, certainly, heading into Congress, is making sure that we have a modern federal financial aid system.
Well, and do you think that what you're talking about, though, is going to be doable? This has been a problem that has existed for many years. It's only gotten worse. And it doesn't seem like there's been an appetite in Washington to actually focus on it and do something about it.
Well, you know, one of the opportunities here is that in our oversight role, it's very clear that Betsy DeVos and the Department of Education has been trying to unilaterally dismantle public education in our country, take away protections from K-12 students and college students. And so this is going to be an area where, like it or not, people are going to have to intervene in this education space. So it's my hope that as we're doing some oversight activities to protect these core civil rights and protections, we're also going to be able to work on this looming economic crisis that is really holding back millennials and Generation Z. This is not a problem that our generation created. We are simply experiencing some market forces and lack of government investment in higher education, and it's really coming to a head. And so burying our heads in the sand as a Congress is not an option. And so I am looking forward to being a strong voice in support of reform.
One of your fellow members of Congress from Illinois, Democrat Bill Foster, has come out against Nancy Pelosi in her bid to be the Speaker of the House. You supported Pelosi, but do you think that Democrats and Nancy Pelosi should figure out who the next person is going to be to satisfy people like Bill Foster who want a succession plan and want somebody younger to take over?
Well, I can't speak for Congressman Foster, but what I will say is that, you know, it's very clear that the American people are interested in a new generation of leadership. And with the election of, you know, candidates like myself and my new colleagues and this 100 incoming new members in the 116th Congress, we have lowered the average age of Congress with our election because at 32 years old, I am not the youngest member, right? And so that says something. There are at least three women younger than me. There's another 32-year-old man in our freshman class.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is younger than you, right? She's in her 20s.
Well, right. Alexandria, Abby Fichenauer, Katie Hill. Those three women are younger than me. Josh Harder is also 32 from California. And then there's a few others that are still millennials that are a couple years older than me. And so we as a cohort represent the beginning of this generational shift. And so I believe that Leader Pelosi recognizes this desire in the caucus. We certainly have younger leaders and Democratic in the leadership, elected leadership in our caucus now. And I think that this is something that we are going to continue to see occur over the next several years. I am not going to say that this is just a Nancy Pelosi problem. This is something that all of the Democrats in the caucus, as we vote for leadership, certainly should keep in mind and recognize the potential in so many of our colleagues.
Well, it's not just Nancy Pelosi, as you say. I mean, there are also two other people in their late 70s who are in the Democratic leadership right now. Do you think at least one person in the three should be somebody that's younger?
Well, first of all, we've already voted. Right. So this has happened. I supported Leader Pelosi, Majority Leader or incoming Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, and incoming Whip Jim Clyburn. And I have great faith in their leadership, and I believe that they will do an excellent job on behalf of the American people. Now, in terms of a pipeline, I do think that, you know, they have heard the message loud and clear. And I have offered myself as someone who is willing to step up when needed to help as situations arise, right? And I know I'm not the only one. So many of us ran because it's very clear that this moment in our country is calling for great leadership. And that type of leadership is not one that's limited to any one generation.
Now, you aren't the youngest, as you say, but you are the youngest Black woman ever elected to Congress. What does that mean to you?
Well, you know, the Congress is an institution that at the dawn of our country, only white, wealthy male landowners were allowed to serve in the Congress, were allowed to cast a vote in this country. We have not seen or heard from younger women of color in any type of cohort or any significant way. And when I say significant, I mean beyond just one pioneering voice. And now there are a few of us under 40 serving in Congress, people, you know, younger women of color. And I think that this is a really special moment in our nation's history, because when we think about our country and the changing demographics of our country, it's vitally important that all of us are represented. It's clear that representation matters in the policies we address, how we approach the job, and the perspectives that we bring to the work. And I am so honored to stand on the shoulders of giants who came before me. You know, our election day was 50 years and one day after Shirley Chisholm was first elected to the Congress. And I know that I have been inspired by her leadership, in addition to so many of the other members who are incoming. I don't think that Shirley Chisholm's portrait has been on social media more than it had been during our 2 weeks of orientation, because as I watched the Twitter and the Instagram of my new colleagues, right, I saw so many of us stopping by Ms. Shirley's portrait and reflecting on the wonderful opportunity that all of us have to lead and to cast a vote in this esteemed body. And so it's not just my story, right? But I'm thinking of the Ayanna Pressleys and the Johanna Hayes and the Lucy McBath and the Alexandrias and all of our new colleagues coming into the Congress who have been inspired by her exceptional leadership.
That is Lauren Underwood, who will be one of the 40 new Democrats taking seats in the House of Representatives next month. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeremy. It's been real fun. Looking forward to keeping people updated after swearing in. It's going to be a really exciting time, and I'm looking forward to getting to work.
One of the many conversations we've been having with some of the new members of Congress.
Google CEO Sundar Pichai is testifying before the House Judiciary Committee today in a much-anticipated hearing after Google declined to send a representative to Congress back in September when Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg and others were in the hot seat. You remember President Trump accused Google of rigging search results. Conservatives said it suppressed their writing. Well, today they got to question Pichai. The Republican Representative Kevin McCarthy kicked things off.
All of these topics, competition, censorship, bias, and others point to one fundamental question that demands the nation's attention. Are America's technology companies serving as instruments of freedom or instruments of control?
For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Shireen Ghaffari covers Google for Recode, has been watching Pichai's testimony today. Shireen, first of all, what was the tone overall?
I mean, I'd say you definitely had several members of Congress who were quite angry with Sundar Pichai. It was similar in tone to what we've seen in previous hearings with other tech CEOs, such as Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, and well, as we heard just now, there are questions about how Google collects user data, flags hate speech, what its plans are in China. But what we've heard the most, as you said in this hearing, is does Google silence conservative information? Here's Representative Lamar Smith, the Republican from Texas.
Dr. Robert Epstein, a Harvard-trained psychologist, authored a study recently that showed Google's bias likely swung 2.6 million votes to Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. Google could well elect the next president with dire implications for our democracy. This should be a real concern to all but the most politically partisan.
Shireen, we heard the study cited many times during the hearing. Tell us more about what they're talking about.
Well, you know, as Google CEO Sundar Pichai said, independent studies there's been independent studies that have been done about this that haven't shown Republican bias. However, Republican lawmakers cited several studies or cited different studies and were citing kind of sometimes their own personal experiences, Googling themselves and seeing what they saw to be more negative content on the Google search results. However, it's still very much debated, you know, the legitimacy of sort of those accusations. And I think you'll see in the coming days people starting to analyze on both sides what research has been.
Well, the Republican Steve Chabot from Ohio said he personally experienced Googling his own bill. It was a bill that would have killed the Affordable Care Act. And he said he had to go through 4 pages of search results before he could find one positive article, one in favor of his bill. Now, it could just be that there weren't that many positive articles, or people weren't as interested. You know, people were interested in articles, you know, people were interested in articles that supported the Affordable Care Act. But Pichai's answers sounded kind of vague. Let's listen.
It's important to us to demonstrate that our products work without any bias, and we build our products in a neutral way. And I'm happy to follow up and look forward to, getting a chance to explain it better.
Shireen, how are you feeling about his answers?
Well, I think this is somewhere where you just see a big gap and divide between some of the conversations that might be happening in Silicon Valley or within Google's own company, where employees are up in arms over issues, but not necessarily accusations of conservative bias within the actual search results. So, you have one perspective coming from Republican lawmakers, and then you have Democratic lawmakers like Rep. Ted Lieu, who today said if Republican leaders want to see more positive search results, they should do more positive things, and called on politicians not to blame social media companies, but blame themselves for bad press.
Yeah. Look,
so I think, Pichai is trying to balance both of those viewpoints in his responses.
Look, one of the things that we heard from both sides of the aisle was that Google controls 90% of all searches. Sitting behind Pichai today was this provocateur who dresses up as the Monopoly man with a mustache and a monocle. It's actually a woman named Amanda. We've spoken with her. We'll link you to the story about her at hereandnow.org if you were wondering who is that Monopoly man sitting there in the hearing. But do you see antitrust regulation on the horizon for Google? Because it's been threatened.
You know, I'm not sure. It hasn't. There's been threats of regulation today. I heard one member say if we do regulate something along the lines of if we do regulate Google, you won't like what it looks like. However, they've seen so far, the questions have seemed to focus more on specific issues such as anti-conservative bias or a censored search product in China, and not as much on Google being monopoly as a whole.
Yeah. At one point, one of the president's advisors, Larry Kudlow, said the Trump administration was open to regulating search results, but they seem to distance themselves from that. But we'll keep an eye on that. Shireen Ghaffari, covering Google's testimony today before a Senate committee, a congressional committee for Recode. Shireen, thank you.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.